Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists.
Our guest today is Tim Kennedy. He's a representational painter who works to present still lifes, figures, and landscapes with immediacy and intimacy. He also works as a senior lecturer at Indiana University Bloomington and was winner of the Clark Hulings Fund 2014 grant. Tim, can you take a minute and just tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Sure. As Daniel mentioned, I paint representationally. I studied at Carnegie Mellon in the 70s. I attended the Skowhegan School. I got a graduate degree at Brooklyn College. In fact, one of my teachers at Brooklyn, Larry Anderson, just passed away last week. I had a show this past spring, in March at the First Street Gallery, Pingtown, where I had, landscapes and, still lives and also figure compositions, from my life here in Bloomington. I teach at Indiana University, teach painting and drawing. That sort of sums it up.
Okay, well, great, Tim. Normally our show sort of starts off with a little bit of focus on the art side of things and then dovetails into a pretty substantial focus on the business side of art. So let's start with the art side of the business first. So, Tim, what inspired you to work with a more traditional art form versus, say, modern mediums?
Well, truthfully, when I was studying, I went back and forth. I mean, I painted abstract. I would have periods where I painted abstractly and then painted from recognizable subjects. I don't see a huge distinction between them, actually. Strangely, when I was at Brooklyn, which is had a reputation for being a pretty traditional program, I was painting abstractly. But I still think that tradition is vital. I like looking at things in the world and doing paintings of them.
Well, now, you produce work on canvases that are up to 6 feet across. And in fact, we did a video and panel discussion on the Clark Hulings Fund that people can see where we ask you about that and we talk about it. But can you speak a little bit to the difficulties involved in working on such large pieces?
Well, in a sense, they're the same difficulties as of doing anything, I suppose. But, you know, there is the question of transporting things. When I do work from a motif, I set certain restrictions for myself because I don't work with from photography. At least I haven't for, you know, this group of things. And one of the restrictions is it would be difficult to take a 6 foot canvas out and paint it on site. So I'm doing it from a series of studies, and then there was a large piece that was in the show that had two figures of it and it set against a lake, and I painted those figures actually in the studio. There's another painting of a family group that, again, I painted those people in the studio. In fact, an article is going to be coming out, in January, that's going to be talking about the whole process of the creation of that painting that's going to appear in the Artist magazine.
You don't just paint. You work as a senior lecturer. So what responsibility do you think we have in passing on knowledge to the next generation?
You know, it's a funny question because when I studied, I think that in different art schools, it was almost discouraged to tell people too much on the how-to kind of aspects of things about painting from a motif. It was sort of the time of process art and abstract expressionism had been not too far in the distant past. So in a funny way, I didn't have too much information when I was going through art school itself. I think that it can't be too specific, but when I do teach, I do teach people how to paint from things that they can see and that kind of thing. I actually teach an anatomy class at at IU as well.
Well, so what inspires you overall to teach? Is it that sense of obligation? Is it pure enjoyment? Do you use it to pay your bills and supplement your income, or is it everything?
Well, I mean, it's more like everything, to tell you the truth. I enjoy teaching. It makes me sort of examine my own beliefs as I do it. But I think it's actually a really interesting thing. And I mean, I get to spend time around other people that are interested in it. One of the things that they have at IU is a graduate program, and the students that are going through it are very, very good. And so it makes you think about the kinds of things that you value. And naturally you want to share your attitudes toward things with them, but you discover stuff that you hadn't thought about either.
Well, I wonder, you teach in Indiana. I wonder how location has impacted your career as an artist. I mean, you live in Indiana, you moved there from New York. Has your location impacted your career?
Well, Bloomington is not a center per se, you know. I mean, it's basically out in the country. We're about a 5-hour drive even from Chicago. You do want to stay in touch with the centers, and we'll make points of visiting Chicago or New York several times a year. On the other hand, maybe you're surrounded by things that feel more like life in a weird way than when I was living in New York. And I think that their subjects present themselves to be painted. And then also maybe there are fewer distractions. You know, I'm able to get more work done, I suppose.
Yeah, so that means that, you know, while some people may think there's a negative business impact from moving to from a larger market to a smaller, if thriving one, nonetheless, there can be some other intrinsic benefits to the art that positively impact your art as a business and your saleability. So that sort of brings us around to the grant. You know, you applied for a Clark Healings 2014 grant to execute a business project. What was your experience like as a grant recipient?
Well, it was really a key thing for that group of work and that show. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't received it. It was just really a key in helping me get the work to New York to show. I was able to hire an art shipper with it, and there were a lot of other expenses that it covered as well.
Now, this is a show. It was the First Street Gallery in New York in March of 2015. Mm-hmm. And I believe you mentioned transportation. So transportation is a key element that most artists need, especially with large format works, which you called out earlier. You used it for transportation to the show in New York. But also, I think there was funding to have an attendant on duty at the Co-op Gallery so the show could be open to visitors more hours. What all did it go for? And, you know, this was a very thoroughly articulated project, which is how you get accepted for a grant. Is that about it? Is there more detail to it?
Well, I mean, truthfully, in terms of the gallery, I mean, it is, as you mentioned, it's a co-op. And so I pay dues each month. The attendant is actually covered as part of my dues, so that's a sort of an included thing. But I guess most of what the Ewing's grant went to was the shipping. There was a portion of it that also I published a little fold-out mailing piece that I wrote an essay for and that sort of thing. And that was kind of a key way of documenting the show and also sending it out to people that might be interested in seeing it.
So there was a collateral and marketing piece too. So how did this show then impact your career overall? Was it a drop in the bucket? Was it significant? Did you see any movement of the needle in terms of boosting your career?
Well, I mean, I think it has. I mean, you know, it's always the thing with showing at First Street, and it's something that I do it every 3 years, and it's an incremental thing. I mean, people know about the shows, people come to see them, and it's not it's almost by perseverance, I suppose, that I present a new body of work each of the times that I've done it. And, you know, people do kind of almost come to expect it. I got a lot of good, you know, verbal response to the show. I mean, maybe more this show than any other that I've had. This has actually been a pretty good year for me in terms of sales. I don't depend on that in any way. I mean, the teaching at, IU is what supports me, but I even so, I had a fair amount of success this year, and then beyond that, as I mentioned, there's going to be an article on that particular painting, that family portrait, the Cassandra Hicks portrait, and there's going to be an article. Well, I wrote the article. But it's going to be appearing, I think, in January.
I love this model that you're using. I mean, you're making a steady income doing something related to your art that's satisfying to you, that gives back. It ensures a steady stream of income so you can do what you want with your art. But at the same time, then, you're focused on actually growing your art as a business. Of course, you know, the Clark Hulings Fund grant process and some of the tools we provide helps with that. But you're really on it. And I think this is very common. When I first went into business for myself, I run a marketing company called Manpipe, and I kept my day job, my corporate job, so that I had a steady stream of income. And I used that money as capital to help start me along the path of my business. And I was able to make choices that were different because I wasn't bound to moment-to-moment checks coming in or not coming in. And those choices were pivotal and really helped me to grow my business. I love the idea that, like many people now in the sort of flexible and contingent workforce we see, you have multiple irons in the fire. And I think that's really key. You know, when we were growing up, you know, our grandparents used to tell us, make sure you learn a trade, right? So that if whatever you're doing doesn't work out, you can fall back on being a, you know, carpenter or whatever it is. And now I think the advice is more like have multiple income streams, you know, just like you diversify your investments. If you're investing money for your retirement, you want to diversify your income and have multiple ways to do it. So I love this notion that you have a fully outfitted business and career that involves multiple income streams. You mentioned that the gallery, that the First Street Gallery, was a co-op situation. Can you clarify, how does that work? How do co-op situations work on the spectrum of gallery representation options versus other ones?
Well, there's a real history to these, and actually, First Street has been around for a long time. I think they had a 50th anniversary show a year or two ago. But this is there's a real history to this stuff. You know, for instance, there were in the 1950s some famous co-ops that started. One of the most famous ones was something called the Tanager Gallery. But all the people that were in that gallery were people that have, like, pretty significant careers at this point. Lois Dodd, Alex Katz, Philip Perlstein, Leonard Anderson, who, like I say, just passed away. They were all in that gallery. They turned down Andy Warhol, you know. But it was a significant gallery. I guess it eventually did go out of business. But there are many of these co-ops that exist in New York. First Street is one. Let's see, Bowery is another. You know, as some of them are very good galleries that get reviewed.
So let me ask you, what advice do you have for future applicants to the Clark Hulings Fund grants? And what are your biggest takeaways from being an applicant yourself?
Well, I mean, some of the things you were mentioning, I mean, very kind of true. The idea of income streams and the kinds of, you know, I've had to do this my whole artistic life, is have some other way to, you know, supplement what I'm doing. But the idea is that there's a core belief in what I'm doing and that I'm sort of constantly representing it. I mean, it fits into the artistic culture at large, and that it's sort of a DIY kind of culture where you're doing it yourself. I almost think of it almost not so much as a business as I think of it almost as perpetually running for office, in the sense that I have an idea that I want to present to people. In terms of advice, I would say think of projects that you want to complete and ways of getting them before an audience that you want. And things like the Ulinks Fund, which, you know, again, was very generous and really appreciated their support, you know, might contribute to your project.
You know, I love that you're calling it out as a project, because that is really, really critical. You know, we're not going to award money in an ongoing relationship for something that is sort of a good theoretical idea. You know, we need something a little more concrete. And what I guess if I could add to your list of tips, it would be, number one, put it on your calendar. So that's the first sort of project direction, is schedule it. Make sure that you have it for September of next year, that you're on this applying for the Clark Ulinks Fund grant. Second, have a well-developed proposal. You know, be as specific and as tangible as you can about what you're trying to achieve, how you're going to achieve it, what tools and methods you're going to use, and how this money will be used. And it's more than just money, so there are tools and introductions and education involved in getting a grant from the Clark Ulinks Fund. So how would you apply those things? And then the third tip I would give is start working with us early. So one of the things we do with grant recipients is interviews like this, and also ask for, you know, things like content contributions, you know, some thought leadership, some insights and some advice, so that we have a way to create a community around this notion of building art careers as successful businesses. So I just absolutely love that you called it out as almost a kind of project management, and you used the phrase running for office. I thought that was hilarious. That's great, especially given what we're going into now.
I know.
We can see some projects that aren't being managed as well as maybe, you know, didn't have the forethought, and probably most of us would not have put our funds behind that project from some of what we're seeing.
Great.
Can you kind of give me a general perspective about what the art market or industry is like today versus when you first started out? You know, has it shifted, and in what ways?
Well, it probably has shifted. It's, again, you know, the cultural landscape for everything has shifted. I think when I first started out, it was, you know, it seemed like a few things that there seemed to be almost as if there was the major fight was between whether something was abstract or was something was figurative. And there also was like a great deal of comparison, I think, between if you were decided to be a representational painter, there was a lot of discussion about whether why would you be doing that as opposed to doing photography? And almost all of those things don't exist as arguments anymore, which is really very unexpected. I think abstract painters and figurative painters just feel like that they're on the same team, and painting itself is maybe a little beleaguered. There isn't much of a comparison to photography anymore. People don't think about that so much. I would say sometimes people don't understand the difference between a physical object and like a digital image, which is a strange thing. I would say in terms of representational galleries, in a strange way, that world has shrunk. There were more representational galleries, you know, when I was living in New York 20 years ago. Schulkopf and places like that, Tadischef, those places don't exist anymore. So that's a funny kind of thing. I'm thinking also too, something I sense is that there was a kind of a centralized authority to the art world 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and I get a sense that maybe that's dissipating a little bit.
Well, I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit on that. What do you mean exactly?
I don't know. It's just a sense I have of saying. I think I think people put less importance or put less credence in things like the major art publications and that kind of thing. a lot of influence seems to go to smaller venues that are online. Like there's something called Hyperallergic that I get online, and that is kind of interesting. But it doesn't have the same kind of. It doesn't feel like they're carved stone hand tablets that are being handed down. You know, it feels more informal, and I don't know, the art hierarchy feels a little bit more informal. But maybe that's just my read on it. Maybe I'm misreading it. I don't know.
Well, I no, I think these are fairly prescient insights. I mean, I love that you're calling out that, and it's probably partly due to the rise of social media and the ubiquitization of online culture and mobile media that, for instance, people don't necessarily think of a painting as a three-dimensional work anymore.
Yeah, I know. It's a little troubling, too.
Yeah, I mean, because what we miss, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think something like Instagram is really, really important for marketing your business as an artist, and certainly there are other visual tools. Almost every social medium has gone visual, Twitter, Facebook. But what you lose is you lose the textures, the brush strokes, the sense of the object itself. That really is part of the art. There really is a difference between a painting and a print, and I think perhaps with, you know, I don't mean to paint anybody with a broad brush, but I think perhaps among sort of the millennial generation, there's something getting lost in the translation.
I think there is something true about that. But I think also, too, is that maybe part of it, again, you know, I'm very old school with this stuff. And to tell you the truth, I a lot of the social media goes over my head. I don't take as much of advantage of it as I probably could. On the other hand, I don't, it's just not part of my world, to the extent that it would be for a person that was a little bit younger than I am. But that idea of the tangibility and sort of sticking with something, I think that's my niche in a funny way, is that I maybe the fact that people will ultimately miss something that has the tangibility and reality of a painting done on canvas, and that they'll like the experience of coming to see the actual piece as opposed to having an image of it online. That's what I'm banking on, I suppose. I hope I'm right.
Right. And then, of course, it falls upon galleries and venues to create much more of an experience than just come and see it, because we can see the image of the piece anyway. Through other means. So you have to kind of, it's more than just wine and cheese now. I think you have to create a much more immersive experience as a gallery owner or as a venue owner or as curator of a museum, etc. Speaking of that then, has your initial marketing strategy since you first became an artist or first started out treating your art as a career, has it shifted with the times? Is it pretty much the same? I mean, even without social media, maybe you have, it has evolved in some ways.
Again, I'm a novice with the social media, and I mean, I'll do things like I'll post the show on, I posted the show on Facebook and those sorts of things. I know that the importance of like an actual tangible thing like the mailing piece we discussed is probably less important. But on the other hand, I like the fact that it is something that is real, that you can hold, and that we have a physical record of it. I think that there was a friend that had a show recently, and she was having a big argument with her gallery as to whether there would be a printed card or not. And, you know, I mean, again, she's... we're about the same age, I suppose, and the idea that you would have a physical record of it was important to her. And I do think that there is something about still hanging onto that is, at least for me, it's an important thing.
Earlier you talked about, you know, what a co-op gallery was and so on, but has there been a particular gallery approach that's worked best? You know, one-man shows, concentrating on galleries that target their best customers, just hanging pieces for visitors to discover. Is there a methodology that for you has been preememinent?
Well, again, I think it fits, I suppose, more of you know, what I want to do as an artist, and ultimately that's what I'm really keying it toward. The thing that's important for me is the idea of having a one-person show. And I don't want to do it every year, but I mean, the idea that it does happen at regular intervals is important to me. And I think, again, the key here is that it's a kind of an artistic statement, and it tells people about the intent of the work. My thought is that over time, people will recognize that. And I think that, like I say, I think there's a word of mouth aspect of what I do that some people are aware of it anyway.
As we're winding down, I want to just ask you a couple more questions. So how can artists balance their craft with the need to make money, sort of the market versus the muse approach?
Well, it does have, you know, it's important probably to have, as you're saying, like a series of income streams. And again, teaching, at least for the past 20 years, has been important for me. When I lived in New York, I did do some teaching. I taught in an adjunct capacity at different schools around New York. But I also did other things to make a living. I did graphic design. I think the idea would be that you could support the thing that you're serious about, and if it works out that it takes off in some enormous way, you know, wonderful. But you're not tailoring it so that it just fulfills that function, if you know what I mean.
How do you ensure that you understand your audience, and is that even important from a purely artistic perspective?
I'm not sure I do entirely understand my audience or a audience, but I mean, what I've recognized over time is that I'm sort of creating a narrative of what I would like that audience to be, I suppose. And I suppose that I would like it to be people that are familiar with and appreciate painting, that it somehow is tied to day-to-day life. I would hope that they would be people, I mean, they don't have to be incredibly wealthy people, but they would be able to make their own judgments about what they like and what they don't like. And again, you know, I mean, a part of it is just that that will ensure the existence of this group of things, whether I'm here or not.
That's a great answer. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for Visual Artists. To see more of Tim Kennedy's work, visit timkennedypaintings.com. That's timkennedypaintings.com. For more information on the Clark Hewlings Fund, visit clarkhewlingsfund.org. That's clarkhewlingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Tim. It's been really great having you.
Pleasure. Thank you.